All right. Well, let's get started then. So first of all, as I mentioned last week, I want to thank Michael and Ruthie Mammon for dedicating the year of Shoftim. Thank you. Thank you very much, Michael.
Pleasure.
Last time we, after we did a brief review, we started on Perek Tezvav, chapter 15 in Shoftim. And what we saw was this intense back and forth between Shimshon and his former wife's family, as well as, in his mind, his current wife's family, and the locals, in which Shimshon is very angry because his wife has apparently gone on married somebody else. His father-in-law says, well, come on, the relationship wasn't that deep anyway, just go with her sister. Shimshon is livid and takes it out on the fields in the area, burning the fields through the method, the fox method, as we talked about last time. The people in the area are very upset and decide that they are going to burn Shimshon's father-in-law and his former bride. And Shimshon is angry at them, and so he brawls with them as well. And that brings us to the story that we just briefly introduced at the end last time. We're in Perek Tesvav, chapter 15, Pasuk Tes, sentence 9. And the story begins really with Psukim Tes Yud Gimel, sentences 9 to 13. So I think what we'll do is start by reading those again. So, Vayalu Filishtim Vayachanu Bihuda Vayinatashu Balechi. The Plishtim ascend and camp in Yehuda, whether that ascend is a reference to going up in holiness as they're entering Yehuda, or whether it's topographical because they're coming up to Yehuda from where they had been in the southwest, in the area of Aza, unclear. But they camp in Yehuda, they sprawl out in a place called Lehi, which commentators generally assume is named because of this this story. Ralbag disagrees about that naming, but that tends to be what we understand. So, Vayomru Ish Yehuda, the people of Yehuda said to the Plishtim, Lama Alisem Aleinu, why are you showing up here against us? Meaning this is an aggressive action that you are taking. Vayomru, and they said, Lasor Es Shimshon Alinu Lasos Lo Kasher Asalanu. We are here to imprison Shimshon, to do to him what he did to us. We've had enough of this Shimshon character. We're here for blood. So 3,000 members of the tribe of Yehuda go to this area called Seif Sela Etam, which was mentioned back in sentence 8 as Shimshon's residence. Everybody knows where Shimshon lives. They said to him, what in the world have you done to us? You know the Plishtim are in charge. And now with what you've done, you've created problems for the rest of us. And Shimshon's response is an interesting response. He says, yeah, what they did to me, I did back to them. That's Shimshon's justification for his activities. So I just want to read a couple of more sentences here, and then we're going to have to figure out what's going on. What did that exchange mean between Shimshon and the people of Yehuda? Vayomrulo, they said to him, we have come to imprison you and turn you over to the Plishtim. Vayomalem Shimshon, Hishava Uli Pentiv Gun Biatem. So Shimshon says, swear to me that you won't attack me. Vayomulole Morlo, and they said, no, we wouldn't do that. Kiasor Nesarcha, why would you think we would want to do that? Kiasor Nesarcha, we're just gonna tie you up. Usanucha biadam, and then we'll hand you over to them. That's all. Vayames Lodami Sacha, we would never kill you, as if. Yeah, the Shimshon thinking to himself, who are you kidding? They and they take two new ropes, tie him up, and they bring him up from there. Okay, so as we noted at the end last time, this is clearly another level of betrayal, right? This is another level of somebody harming someone who trusted them. Shimshon has already gone multiple rounds of betrayal before, and now you get another round in which the people of Yehuda betray Shimshon. That seems fairly clear. However, they accuse Shimshon of being the one to trigger it. They say, look, you're the one who started this by getting us in trouble. Now, a couple of fact points about this story. It doesn't say here how many Plishtim there are, right? It doesn't say how many Plishtim showed up. We don't know if it's a delegation of a few people or if it's a military camp. But jump ahead to sentence 15, where Shimshon is going to fight the Plishtim and tell me how many people are there.
He kills a thousand, so there must be a thousand there.
Right. You've got minimum of 1,000 people. They, how many more? Anybody's guess, but minimum 1,000 are there. So they're ready for war, the Plishtim. They are anticipating trouble. The back and forth between Yehuda and the Plishtim is a very interesting back and forth. In other words, the Plishtim come to them and say, and Yehuda says to them, why are you here? And if you take a look on the source sheet, I brought you Rashi's read when they say that, Lama li sem aleinu, why are you here? Halo avadim anachnu lachem. We are your servants. We have not rebelled. Why is it that you've come? And their answer is, we've come to imprison Shimshon. And Shimshon gives this this response of, he hit me first. Right? That's essentially Shimshon's response. So what questions come to mind for you in reading this this passage? Is it all just like obvious? I mean, I see things here that are not so obvious to me.
Why wouldn't they go to Shimshon directly? Like, why indicate that you're too afraid to go after him yourselves?
That's interesting. Are they indicating that they are afraid to go after Shimshon themselves? Go back to sentence 9 and tell me whether that resonates there. Or 9 and 10. It's an interesting point, but I'm not so sure. Did the Plishtim really come to Yehuda for help?
It seems like
I think they did.
Chuck
because
thinks they did.
They may very well have doubted their ability to capture Shimshon, and they was putting the people of Yehuda at risk because the Plishtim could have hurt the people of Yehuda, and that's why he went along, arguably, and said, I'll go with you as long as you don't attack me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you can't attack Shimshon because he is invincible in a fight, you might as well attack the people he cares about. And if he can't protect them, unless he goes along with them, that might have been the plan.
So you can read it that way, but they didn't actually make the approach to the people of Yehuda.
Yeah, the people of Yehuda went up to them. Like they kind of stopped them, said, why are you here?
Right. It's really not so clear how this is going. The only thing that is clear to me is that Yehuda expects a fight from Shimshon. The people of Yehuda believe that Shimshon is not on their side. Because how many men did the Plishtim bring? Minimum 1,000. How many men did Yehuda bring when they went to Shimshon?
3,000.
3,000. They think that there's a fight coming. They believe that Shimshon actually wants to fight with them.
Can I ask a geography question here?
Yes.
Okay. Where is everyone located in the way of direction? So, in other words, the Plishtim are coming from the water, heading towards Yehuda, which is towards the central. Where is Shimshon's house?
So Shimshon's house is not, it's not clear where Sela Ein Itaim is. I don't know. See if Sela Ein Itaim, I should say. However, generally speaking, he straddles the line between Yehuda and Dan, which puts him not far from the Plishtim at all.
Right. So they are heading to Yehuda. That's why I'm asking, because he would be in between where the Plishtim are and where Yehuda is.
Could be. As I say it, I'm looking at the Dat Mikra, and the Dat Mikra actually places this south of Beit Lechem, which is interesting. That's further east than I would have expected this to be. Further east and further north. They mention a place called Ein Eitan, which is south of Beit Lechem. I don't know. So in answer to your question, Howie,
what is the significance of Howie's question of the directions? Is he trying to...
I'm trying to ascertain if they're heading to Yehuda in order to get Yehuda to work on their behalf. In other words, they were closer to Shimshon the first place than there shouldn't have been any interaction with Yehuda.
Right.
There's an interaction with Yehuda.
Right. I mean, what's very unclear to me in this is the question of whether they chose not to go to Ein Itaim right away, to see if Sela Ein Itaim right away, I should say, in order to get Yehuda on their side. Was that what was going on? That's not clear to me. Is everybody able to hear properly?
Yes.
Okay, I'm asking because my computer is doing all sorts of cartwheels. So I don't know. I have lost your screens multiple times, but I keep hearing Howie and David. So that's my that's my clue that we're still going on here.
We lost you. I didn't see you. I didn't see or hear you for a few seconds after Howie spoke.
Okay. As long as we're good now. I think I'm going to turn off my video for a little bit and see if that helps in terms of my signal. But I'm still here. Okay. So let's think this through here. Take a look at the source sheet, please. It's source number 2 from Mitzudat David, Rav David Altshuler. He says that when the people of Yehuda come to Shimshon, they say, "La'esar chayaradnu, we have descended in order to bind you, in order to tie you up." Ki haplishtim gazru aleihem la'osro la'havio. He thinks that it actually was a plishti demand. And that's Malbim's view as well. They're with Chuck. They believe that the Plishtim actually demanded it. It wasn't so in the text, but that's their understanding of what's going on. The other way to read it is to say Yehuda came to him on their own to help their position with the Plishtim. But fundamentally, whether the Plishtim demanded this of Yehuda or whether this was Yehuda's initiative, either way, there's an element again of betrayal. There is. Yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about the question of the halachic ethics of this. What happens if an enemy says, turn over this person or else we kill everybody or we go to war? Now, what's your responsibility? It's a fundamental ethical question which we have to deal with. And we'll see, it's actually surprisingly a machlokas. It's a debate. But before you get into the halacha of it, ask yourself the question. Imagine that a foreign nation, take your pick, comes to Israel and says, we are going to attack unless you turn over, fill in the blank. A politician they don't like, a general who had success against them, right? Iran says, if you don't turn over the fellow who killed Suleiman, we're going to go to war. Can you envision a scenario in which they turn him over?
That would happen in the ghettos all the time.
So in the ghetto position, you are subsidiary to them. In the ghetto position, you're not in any position whatsoever to defend yourself at all. So you're but saying that here it's analogous. They're also not.
Yeah, they're also subsidiary, not quite the same level of control, but they're clearly a vassal.
Mm-hmm.
It says Kimoshlin Banu Plishtim.
Well, that's their explanation for why he shouldn't have done what he did. That's when they say to him, why in the world have you put us in this position? No, they're blaming him.
Kimoshlin means they're subservient. I mean, it's like what Ori's saying. They don't have control.
Mm-hmm.
And in pre-state Israel, they were turning over the Etzel and Irgun people all the time,
mm-hmm.
at the demand of the British.
Interesting.
We're not so great.
Oh, I'm not saying we are. I'm just looking at this and thinking that it's a real betrayal of Shimshon. Well, Shimshon, for his part, as you said, goes along with this.
Well, so there that begs the question, was it a betrayal?
Well, if you do it for self-preservation, does that make it less of a betrayal?
Let's start with the premise that just like Shimshon could beat the 1,000 Plishtim, he could have beaten the men of Yehuda.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the men of Yehuda were cognizant of that.
I would think.
And they negotiated a deal with him. And he went along with it to protect them.
Right.
As opposed to they coerced him. They right. trapped him. They beat him. And then they handed him over.
Right. Or he's even looking at them and giving them a nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Okay, tie me up. Turn me over to them. It's going to be fine.
Right. Well, that's certainly what he's thinking, without a doubt. But I want to show you how Shimshon is taken aback by this move. First of all, something we already noted in Radak a while back, but take a look at source number 3. I reproduced it here. Radak writes, "V'lo ha'Yisrael nelchamim bahem kim Shimshon levado." Under Shimshon, the Jews don't fight the Plishtim. Shimshon does his own thing. He's an individual raider. And therefore, the Plishtim do not have cause to fight the Jews. They have no reason to fight the Jews because of what Shimshon's doing. It was Shimshon's own act. He wasn't acting on behalf of the Jews. He actually lived more among the Plishtim when he harmed them, according to Radak. You know, not that he's always there. This place, Si'if Salaitam, is not in Plishti land. But we'll see a lot of his raids and a lot of his attacks are on Plishti territory. However, because they were afraid of Shimshon, therefore the Plishtim wouldn't attack the Jews. But fundamentally, Shimshon has been trying to avoid this eventuality. He doesn't want the Jews to be brought into this at all. And Malbim says that's what he meant when he said, they hit me first. When the people of Yehuda say, Mazos Asisa Lanu, what have you done to us by angering the Plishtim? He says, Kasher Asuli Kein Asisi Lahem. What they did to me, I did back to them. Take a look at source number 4 in the Malbim. V'hu devarm shebeni leveinam bilti nogim el haklal. This was a personal issue. This was between me and them. It didn't have anything to do with you. So what he's really saying is, as Malbim explains it, I am not at fault here. This isn't about, you should not have been brought into this, and it's not my fault. Nonetheless, he cooperates. Because Shimshon is genuinely concerned for them. And yes, Ori's point that Shimshon believes he's going to be okay is for sure a piece of this. Shimshon, as we're going to see repeatedly, is confident that Hashem is always going to save him. He's always going to get bailed out. But take a look at Ralbag's note, where he says that which we intuit when we read the story. In source number 5, he gives you his lessons from the story of Shimshon. So the 19th lesson that he brings is Lahudia Sharoi Lemanhig Shayishmor Amo Veloyaspik Lo Shmiras Atzmo. You're a good leader, You guard your people. You don't just protect yourself. So Shimshon is willing to put himself on the line to defend them. Now, keep in mind, I am whitewashing Shimshon's record on the betrayal front. My computer seems to have stabilized, so I'm going to try video again. We'll see how long it lasts. But Shimshon is not new to the betrayal game, in the sense that, well, go back to what we said last week. Shimshon, yes, he's kind to the Jews, but he went after Plishti women, which is cast in Tanakh as an act of betrayal, not only of God, but a betrayal of the Jews. If you remember in Malachi, he talks about this in the second chapter in Malachi. He talks about the Jewish men who marry the Canaanite women. And he says, you have betrayed the wife, you have betrayed your wives, meaning the Jewish women, by doing this. So Shimshon is not innocent on that front. But here, he is the victim, and he says, that's okay. I'm not gonna fight it. I'm gonna go along. And then let's take a look at what happens in Pasuk Yudalid. Hu va ad lechi. He gets to lechi, he's tied up. Uplishtim heriu likraso, and the plishtim trumpet to greet him. They're thrilled. Batitzlach alav ruach Hashem. But once again, you get the spirit of God upon Shimshon. For those keeping score at home, this is going to be attack number 4 against the plishtim. Vatihyena ha'avosim asher al zroosav kapishtim asher ba'aru va'esh. The ropes that are on his arms are like flax that has already been burned. Vayimasu asurav me'al yadav, and that which had been binding him, these bonds, simply melt off of his arms. Vayimtsa lechicha mor tiriya, and he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. Vayishlach yadova yikachta, stretched out his hand, grabbed it. Vayachba elefish, and as we said, he strikes 1,000 men. Vayomer Shimshon, and Shimshon said, that was neat. Belechi ha-chamor, chamor chamoratayim. He's a poet, and he didn't even know it. He says, with the jawbone of a donkey, piles and piles. Chamor chamoratayim, right? If you remember with the frogs in Egypt. So at the end of the plague of the frogs, it's buro sam chomorim chomorim. They pile them up. They pile up the frogs and the land smells of them. But chomorim chomorim is a reference to a pile. We use the term chomer. Chomer is used to mean material, but it also is a term for, in Tanakh, a volume measure. So this means piles and piles. He says, that's neat. I use the chamor's jawbone to create chamor chamoratayim of the plishtim. Gerald, do you like the poetry? That's Shimshon for you. Belchi achamor hikesi elef ish. With the jawbone of a donkey, I struck 1,000 men. And one more pasuk. Vayikchalo sola daber. He finishes talking. Vayashleich halachim yado. He throws down the jawbone. Vayikrala makomahu ramas lechi. And he called the place ramas lechi. Ramat, not meaning height here, I think, but meaning to throw, like susva rochva ramavayam. So it's the thrown jawbone. This is the site of the thrown jawbone. So this is really interesting. Shimshon effectively is getting a message here from God, right? Vatitzlach alav ruach Hashem. Hashem's spirit is upon Shimshon. The message that I see is twofold. Number one, the Jews might betray you, but I won't. They're going to turn you over, but I'm still here for you. And you may have betrayed me, but I am still here for you. I'm still not going to betray you. I will still be on your side. That's what I see here. What do you see in this passage of his victory? There's a lot to talk about here, I think. first of all,
Just the sound wasn't good in your question, Rob.
All right, just what do you see here in this story?
Who's he talking to?
Yeah, he's talking to his biographer. That's what it is. I mean, there are no plishtim around to hear the story, to hear what he has to say. He's just sort of mumbling to himself. Hey, what do you know? Lechi chamor, chamor, chamor atayim. That was neat. There doesn't seem to be an audience as far as we can tell. The victory here is credited to Hashem, right? It's not Shimshon's strength. And this was the point we made from Professor Yechezkel Kaufman in the beginning of Shimshon's story, that the message here is a message of everything comes from Hashem. Don't think that it's about the magic hair. It's not about the magic hair. If Shimshon is powerful, it's going to be because Hashem gives him the ability to do this. And he does it with this fresh jawbone. The Dot Mikra edition says fresh jawbone means that it's strong. It hasn't begun to deteriorate. Yechezkel Kaufman suggests that it had the teeth still in it, which is okay. It's a fresh bone. It still has the teeth. Notice that the people of Yehuda do not join in, right? They don't get involved. They're not about to come to his defense, even when he's winning. But what's the message in the use of a jawbone? Like, how about a real weapon? I mean, Sorry.
Just to answer your question, I think it's showing exactly that it is Yad Hashem, that it's not normal warfare. It's not even his ability, his fighting ability. It's so absurd that a jawbone would kill 1,000 people.
Right.
Like a mess. It's supernatural.
Right. Kaufman makes the argument that a jawbone of a donkey is actually a really good weapon because it's easy to hold because of the way the donkey's teeth are spaced. And the truth is, we have that Gemara with Rabbi Akiva, where it talks about a donkey's bite being exceptionally strong. Nonetheless, it seems fairly clear to me that this fits the book-long theme we've been looking at of how Hashem makes us succeed regardless of the weapon, whether it's Ehud's homemade dagger or Shamgar's cattle goat or Yael's tent peg or Gidon's miniature army. It doesn't make a difference. By the way, I noticed on the sheet in source 6, I actually brought the psukim from Malachi. I forgot I had put them on the page, but it's there for you. But take a look at source number 7 at Ralbag, where he says, the 20th lesson he gets out of this story is, Lahudia Otsem Hashkachas Hashem Yisbarach, to show the magnitude of Hashem's supervision. Ad Shesivev Sheish Echad Asur Vizulas Klemil Chama Nitzeach Vehimis Rabim. Yeah, this one man who's tied up, who has no weapons, who is able to defeat many, because God doesn't really care what the odds are. He can help regardless.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I have one difficulty regarding, Shimshon never mentions God's name. Like in his poetry, God's name is absent.
Right. So that is a fascinating point. That was where I was going to go with this, but I'll go there now because you pointed it out. This story is not only Hashem sending a message to Shimshon of, I'm there for you when nobody else is. It's also a test. You have betrayed God already. God is here for you regardless. What are you going to do with that? Will you recognize Hashem or not? And it's so startling here that you get his little valedictory speech about piles and piles, and there's nothing about, wow, Hashem helped me. So we're going to see that that's important as the story continues. The other piece of this that I think relates to what you're saying, Howie, is the act of throwing down the lechi. What does that signify?
A little bit of wilderness. I'm saying even the fact that he just finds a jawbone lying around, it almost feels like the Wild West or some.
I mean, it feels like the Wild West. There's a dead, there's a skeleton of a donkey out there. It's That's for sure. But yeah. What's the image of throwing it down, which, you know, is something that
he's saying it's insignificant. I would have won anyhow.
Yeah. Well, he's saying this. I don't even need the weapon. Take a look at Abarbanel in source number 8. Abarbanel writes, Hishlich halachi miyado. He threw it out down to Omer as if to say, "Any tzarich halachi ole kli achir. I don't need the jawbone. I don't need anything. Ki yadai ravli lehinakem bamei oyvei Hashem. My hands are good enough for me to take revenge against the enemies of God." Now, Abarbanel adds in the religious element to it by saying enemies of God. But fundamentally, he's saying, I didn't even need this. There's an element, it seems, an element of saying, I'm good no matter what. It doesn't make a difference. Yes, Chuck?
I have a question regarding the thrust of where we're going.
Yeah.
I'm taking a look at the Pasuk Yudchet.
Oh, wait, we're not there yet.
You may not be there, but it's in the context of our discussion.
Go ahead.
He says, "Why are you going to kill me from thirst when you gave me such a victory?"
Mm-hmm.
So Shimshon is acknowledging that the victory came, he may have been the vessel, but the victory is from God.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
It's as if it's a part of a larger discussion. God's talking to him. He's talking to God. We may not have full access to the discussion, but clearly from the context of what Pasuk Yuchet is saying, he's crying out to God when he's in need.
Right.
And he's acknowledging, God, you get this victory was through you. So it's not, I don't see the dismissal of everything, the self-aggrandizement, I see an acknowledgement of the divine presence.
Good. So that was where I wanted to go with this. So let's go there. You do need to see the full story. That's absolutely true. So in Pasuk Yudches, Vayitzma Ma'od, he's really thirsty.
Okay, can I interject one second before?
Yeah.
Okay. On what he said in his poetry, we have an answer who he said it to. In other words, Yehuda did not partake in what happened, but is Shimshon just talking to himself, or is he talking to fellow Jews at that time?
So to me, he's saying it to himself. This is his personal declaration.
Okay. If that's what it is, then it's irrelevant. It's relevant. It's in the shoftim, but it doesn't affect anything.
I mean, keep in mind, I haven't gone through it to look for this systematically, but Shimshon has this remarkable sort of out loud inner life in which he makes observations about things aloud as though he has an audience. He does it, you know, he does it here, obviously. But this is not the only place where he's going to make statements like that. He is going to say, for example, one second. Yeah, he's going to make the statement, Tamos Nafshi Im Plishtim, before he brings down the palace on the Plishtim. He's not talking to God there in any way that we can discern from the text itself. He simply speaks. Another example of it, just thumbing through. There maybe not. I was going to say back in the beginning of this parak in Pasuk Gimel, Shimshon says, Nikesi apam plishtim, I'm done with the plishtim. But there it says, Vayomer lahem, he said it to them. So I'm not sure. But he does have this way of making statements. So it's a style. I don't think there has to be an audience. But take a look at these psukim here in Yudches Yudtes, sentences 18 and 19. By the way, I will mention, though, just to Harry's point, about what we gain, what do we learn from this statement that Shimshon makes. So we do have the comment, I think it's Professor Kaufman, who says that Chamor Chamoratayim was meant to also, through the pun, insult the Plishtim. I view them as donkeys. He reads that in. I think it was Kaufman. Okay. But going back to Pasuk Yudches, Vayitzma Me'od, he's very thirsty. Vayikra al Hashem, and he calls out to God, Vayomar, and he says, Atana sata biyad avdecho es hachua gedolazos. You gave this great salvation into the hand of your servant. Ve'ata amus batzama. Now I'm going to die of thirst. V'nofalti biyad ha'arelim. Shall I fall into the hands of the uncircumcised ones? A term that we use repeatedly for plishtim. It's a word that is associated with them for reasons that we're not going to go into right now. But it's a term that you'll see in Shmuel also. So you have turned the, you have given me this great victory, and now I'm going to die of thirst. So as Chuck notes, he's crediting the victory to Hashem. Vayivka Elokim es hamachteish asher balech. And Hashem split open the mortar, the bowl, that was in Lechi. And we have to talk about what that means, because there are a range of views as to what that means. Vayetzu mimenu mayim, water comes out. Vayesh, he drinks. Vatoshov rucho vayechi, his spirit is returned. Now he's back to his strength. Alkein karashima ein hakorei asher balechi. And therefore he decided, I'm going to call it ein hakorei, the spring of the one who calls out, that is in Lechi. Adayom hazeh, and that's what it is called until this day. So Shimshon declares his recognition that the victory came from Hashem. Howie was right that he didn't say anything before. It didn't seem like he was saying it was from Hashem. However, when he gets in trouble, he's thirsty. He says, look, God, I know you helped me with this victory. Please help me. Please help me again. Just in terms of the spring and what happened here, to show you the range of views about where this water came from, Ralbag says Hashem creates a spring in the place called Lechi. However, Rashi quotes you, or bases himself on, the Gemara in Sota. If you take a look at source number 9, this is a Gemara that we quoted once earlier on, that Shimshon desired that which was Tamei. He went after the Plishti woman, and therefore his life depended upon that which was Tamei, meaning the spring was created in the jawbone itself. The jawbone of the donkey was what held the water. Then you have the Targum, the Aramaic commentary, quoted in Radak, who says that Hashem created a spring in a stone under the jawbone. And then you have a Barbanel who says, you're forgetting, he threw the jawbone down on the ground. So he says, and I brought it here in source number 10, Lagid Shemasha Asa Shimshon Bazeme and Akamavach. Sorry, no, that's not it. I thought I brought it on the sheet. I actually don't see it now. Oh, there it is, number 8. That's why I put it in the wrong place. It's not there. Never mind. I didn't bring it on the sheet. But Abarbanel says he threw down the jawbone, and on that spot he made a hole, and that's where the water came from. So all sorts of different explanations.
What's it mean when it says his life depended on that which was Tamei? What's Tamei?
The jawbone of the donkey.
Oh, right. Yeah. But that's not really an explanation. That's just an aside.
What do you mean?
Well, you were listing out explanations of where the water came from.
Right. So that one is suggesting that it's actually in the jawbone. Hashem produces the water from the jawbone itself.
Right.
But what's fascinating to me here is that Shimshon names the spring for the way it came when he called out to Hashem. Malbim actually says that this is meant to induce people to bless God when they see that spot. Like the Gemara in the end of Brachos talks about, when you see a place where a miracle took place, So you should bless Hashem. So Shimshon is trying to do that. So Shimshon has effectively righted the wrong of what he did after the battle. After the battle, he did not give Hashem credit, and now he has decided that he's going to give Hashem credit.
But where do we see that he thanks Hashem for the water? We see that when he was thirsty, he was acknowledging that what happened with the jaw was Hashem. We don't see thanking at all, or even acknowledging that the water came from Hashem.
Well, what do you think it means when he names the place? This is the spring of the one who called out.
Well, it still doesn't quite say Hashem's name. I mean, the one who called out doesn't say the one who answered. Like, it's a very indirect way, obscure way of thanking Hashem. You know, somebody called out here. Like, no one's going to say, oh, really? Who called out to who?
What would you have had to call it?
A faint thank you or acknowledgement.
It's the one who answered. What did you call it?
Inha,
called out.
Hashem. Nali.
I'm agreeing with David in that when you call it the one who called out, Shimshon is praising himself, that he's the one that God answered versus the one who answered him. It's
interesting. I hear you. I turned off the video because my computer was slowing down again. But
I see David's point in this, and it's not really explicit saying God. It's more people will say Shimshon was answered here.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Shimshon fundamentally, and if we didn't know this already, we definitely can say it here, is a person of contradictions. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that since he was introduced to us. So it doesn't bother me to say that you can interpret Ein HaKore in two ways. It memorializes prayer and a miracle, or he named it for himself instead of naming it for Hashem.
Yeah.
You could say both things, and that's the nature of Shimshon. I mean, just like he gets into these marriages with the Plishtim, and on the one hand, he's doing it to satisfy himself. It seems fairly clear. He says, good in my eyes, and all the things we've discussed. And at the same time, Hashem wants a reason to attack the Plishtim. And so he's fulfilling the mission that Hashem has given, and he will at times express that he's doing what Hashem wants him to do. And even in terms of the issue of endangering the Jews, on the one hand, he's doing everything solo in Plishti territory, insulating the Jews. At the same time, the people of Yehuda are right. You know, it is endangering them. It's very cute and very, lawyer-like for Shimshon to say, what do they have against you? No offense to lawyers. What do they have against you guys? It's just me acting solo. But everybody knows who Shimshon's people are, and everybody knows that this is the way to get to him. So yes, you have this split, and it's going to continue for the rest of his story. That's the way he is.
Has Shimshon ever acknowledged God in the first place? I don't think he has. This is the first time.
You mean earlier in this, did he ever say anything about Hashem? I don't think he has yet. I think this is the first place. I think that's correct. I mean, he's had experiences with Hashem. So we had in chapter 14, sentence 19, Vatitzlach al Ruach Hashem earlier, right? We saw that there, but he never invoked God in a conversation. He didn't invoke God in the riddle. He didn't invoke God when he was angry at the Plishtim for giving away his wife. He didn't invoke God when he beat the lion, although there again it says Vatitzlach alav ruach Hashem. I don't believe he has actually mentioned Hashem yet. This is the first time.
And even here, it's only, as I said earlier, it's only in a foxhole. It's only because he's thirsty. It's not, anyways, okay, maybe I'm being critical.
You are being critical, but don't worry, because I'm going to defend Shimshon, you'll see. I think Shimshon has a lot more depth to him than he gets credit for. Okay. So let's take a look at one last pasuk here. sentence 20, Pasuk Chav. This is a strange sentence. Vayishpot es Yisrael bimei plishtim esrim shana. He led Israel. Vayishpot, again, is a funny word in general. Does it mean judge? Does it mean led? Does it mean defended in war? Still an unclear word. During the days of the plishtim, they're still living under the plishtim for 20 years. Normally, when you see a sentence like that in Tanakh, what is the next sentence? Normally, when you see a sentence like that.
And he died.
Right. And he died. He was buried in such and such a place, and the Jews strayed from after God. Right? That's what's supposed to be the next sentence in Shoftim. He still has another chapter to go. And what a chapter it's going to be. What in the world happened here? Not only that, jump to the end of chapter 16, sentence 31. After he actually is dead, it describes his burial. And then it says, "Who shafat is Yisrael asrim shana?" He led Israel for 20 years. So why is this line showing up at the end? So four different approaches. Simple explanation is that the story with the first woman, right, this woman he married, and the whole follow-up leading up to the battle in Yehuda were all at the beginning of his career. Then he led the people for 20 years, and then he ran into the problem of the second woman in the beginning of chapter 16 and Delilah. So what we're doing now is describing the beginning of his 20-year leadership. And then at the end of chapter 16, we finish the 20-year leadership, and therefore we go back to say, and he judged for 20 years. That, to me, is the simplest read of this. Abarbanel says no. He says, what we're doing here is explaining how these events that we just read shaped Shimshon's relationship with the Jews. Take a look at source number 10. This is an Abarbanel that I meant to put here. La'gid shemasha asa Shimshon bazeme hanakama v'hatshua v'apele ha'atzum, to teach that what Shimshon did here, his fight against the Plishtim and the miracle that happened, these were hasibasha samu Yisrael shofet. This is why the Jews made him shofet. They looked to him through this 20-year period because of all the things that just happened. So that's why we mention it here, because this is what triggered it. The Yerushalmi takes it in an entirely different direction. Take a look at number 11. The Yerushalmi says that's not what's going on. And remember, the explanation that we just gave didn't really explain the end. Why is it at the end of chapter 16? The Yerushalmi picks on that. And it says, after bringing the two psukim, it says, Amar Rabbi Acha said, Melamid shayu aplishtim yireya mimenu chav shana la'achar moso. Kederach shayu yireya mimenu chav shana b'chayav. It's saying that even after he was dead, they were afraid of him for 20 years. Shimshon had this supernatural hold on them. They were so frightened that they're afraid for another 20 years after this. So that that's what the Yerushalmi says. Rabag has a whole other answer trying to fit in different chronologies. But the answer that I like best, even though all of these answers have clear merit and fit different aspects of the story, whether you take it simply as this is the beginning of the 20 and later is the end of the 20, whether it's about cause and effect, a la Abarbanel, these events led to him ruling for 20 years, or whether it's this Yerushalmi about his impact on them for another 20 years, all of those are strong answers. But I turn back to Kaufman again, because I think his insight is very sharp. Take a look at source number 12. He says, Pulat Shimshon Balechi, Ubkiat Hamayan Betfilato, Hain Sitifarto. He says, what Shimshon does with the jawbone, right? Turning himself over to the Plishtim, and then attacking them with the jawbone, and then this business with the Mayan, with the well, with the spring, that's Si Tifarto. That is the height of Shimshon's splendor. This is Shimshon at his best. He davens to Hashem. Hashem does a miracle to help him. Whereas what's coming next, Hu Sipur al Sofo HaTragi, Tragi. I don't know how that word should be read in Hebrew. But it's the rest of the story. Chapter 16 is tragic. And it really is, as we're going to see. Ve'od, b'tesvav yutes, mistayem ha-sipur ha-mechamos shimshon. B'tezayin mesupar rak ha-gburosav. Further, we're done with Shimshon's wars. Meaning, I told you, we've seen now four different battles from Shimshon. We had the one at the wedding party, right, where he killed 30 people. We had the one with the foxes. Then we had the one against the people who burned his wife and father-in-law. And then we had the one here. That's it for the wars that are going to be recorded in the story. Chapter 16 will have feats of strength, but it's not going to have any more wars. So in other words, this is here because fundamentally we've reached a break point in Shimshon's career. What we've learned about in chapters 14 and 15 has brought Shimshon to his height. His connection to Hashem is stronger now than what we've seen before. Byron pointed out, we hadn't even seen him express a connection with Hashem. Now it's here. He has fought against the Plishtim, but everything is going to change in this next chapter. He will still be very close with Hashem, closer than what we saw. There will be a greater closeness to Hashem coming in chapter 16. But it's not going to be the wars, Hu Yachel Oshias Yisrael, him saving Israel from the Plishtim. That part of it is done.
Is that possibly the symbolism of him throwing down the jawbone, saying, my fighting is over?
That's interesting. I haven't thought about it that way. It's an interesting idea. It would imply that this is a conscious decision. Then I'd have to ask, well, why would he make that decision? Like, why would he decide to do that?
Well, he may have already made that decision before when he went to hide in the rock. And he got pulled out almost against his will in order to save the Jewish people.
Right, assuming we take that as hiding. I mean, one of the big problems here is also going to be the word vayishpot. Because I would have taken that as a military leadership type of a thing. At any rate, he is the head of the Jews at this point. I would have assumed it involved physical attacks against the Plishtim. It's certainly going to seem like it involves physical attacks against the Plishtim. Because keep in mind, when we get to the end of this 20-year period and they take him, right, through Delilah, through his wife, they don't sound like people who are angry about something that happened 20 years ago. They sound like people who are dealing with a live enemy. And frankly, even in the beginning of the chapter where we're going to see this story involving Shimshon and the Isha Zonah, it's also going to seem like he's a live enemy. So that would be a weakness in that idea. I think stuff's going on for the 20 years. I don't think he's gone into retirement. You know, the point that Kaufman makes still stands, because in terms of the story as it's presented in the Navi, there's a break point. But we don't get more stories of his activities. But at the same time, he still has another activity going on, I believe. So what I want to do in the beginning next time is talk through a little bit of the ethical question of whether they should have turned over Shimshon or not. How would that be looked at in Halacha? Before we move on to do Perek Hezayin, chapter 16, and the story of Shimshon in Aza, and eventually then Delilah as well. Okay?
Just a question before you. Just on that one pasuk, Vishpla Yisrael b'mei plishtim esrim shana. The way I read it, it's implying that the plishtim were still ruling in that time while Shimshon is the shofet.
Correct.
So this breaks all the tradition we've had all through Shoftim of the process where you have the Shofet and after he has his victory, you have peace.
Right. So I'd make three points in relation to that. Number one, we've had a question from the start of the book as to when it is that the Jews become good under a shofate. Is it that there's a shofate all the time, like Abarbanel believes there's always a shofate, and the people are bad, and then at some point they become better, and it's not clear whether they become better because of the shofate's activity or whether the shofate becomes powerful because the people became better and therefore Hashem is going to help them. That whole cause and effect is very unclear. But what is clear is there are periods during the reign of a shofate when we are under somebody else's control. I think that's still true. That's one point. Number two, Shimshon is the last shofate. I mean, Shmuel is a shofate, but he's the last one we'll have recorded in this book. There is, we've seen all along, a deterioration that happens step by step. And therefore, it wouldn't surprise me to say that in the time of Ehud, in the time of Devorah, in the time of Gidon, a shofate's success meant that now we were not under anybody. But by the time you hit Shimshon, that's no longer true. It's part of the deterioration. And then the last point that I would make with this is when we first read chapter 13, which predicted Shimshon's rise, it said, "Hu yachel Hoshias Yisrael miyad plishtim," he will begin to rescue the Jews from the plishtim. One of the commentators said he's going to begin it, but he's not going to complete it. And that's what we're seeing. They're under the plishtim throughout his reign. He does not actually throw them off. So whether that's inconsistent with the other plishtim, I'm not sure, but it wouldn't bother me because, again, you're seeing a decline throughout the book. So that would be okay. Not saying I'm happy about, but it would be okay. But yes, there's no doubt. Shimshon never gets rid of the plishtim. And that's true beyond his time. That's going to be true in Shmuel's day. It's going to be true in Shaul. It's going to be true in David. Right? We never get rid of the plishtim. That's the story. Okay. So God willing, next week. Also, you saw my email about Sunday, Tishrei in a day. I hope you'll be able to tune in for at least some part of it. We've got 12 different shiurim. And something for everybody. We've got Tanakh, we've got history, we've got halacha, we have Jewish thought. So hopefully you'll be able to make that. All right. Thank you very much. Have a great night.
Thank you. Have a wonderful night. Bye-bye.